On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
As a longtime college teacher myself and the husband of a woman who taught in public and private schools in junior high and high school for 40 years, the idea of trying to measure how well teachers do and how well schools do in educating students has, as you can imagine, been a big part of all of my life. Two new books in a series here by J.M. Beach from Roman and Littlefield address this very issue and talk about, are we doing it right? Should we be doing it at all? And what can we do? The books are The Myths of Measurement and Meritocracy, How Accountability Metrics in Higher Education Are Unfair and Increase Inequality, and Can We Measure What Matters Most? Why Educational Accountability Metrics Lower Student Learning and Demoralize Teachers. Josh is here with us today to talk about both of his books, what led him to that point, because he is also a very experienced teacher, a lecturer in higher education for more than 20 years in the United States, South Korea, and China, the founder and director of 21st Century Literacy, a nonprofit organization focused on literacy education and teacher training. We are thrilled to welcome Josh to talk to us about what do we need to do, what are we doing wrong, and what might we do instead. Josh, welcome to On the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Doc. Glad to be here.
At what point did you suddenly begin to realize that the way that we judge whether teachers are doing a good job and overall are schools doing a good job is fraught with flaws?
Well, I think for me, like a lot of people, it started when I was a student, you know, probably back in middle school, high school. Mm-hmm. You know, you have that sense of the teachers that are well admired by the administration are not necessarily well admired by the students. Right. And as a student, I got a sense that there were some teachers that truly cared about me and my learning, and they were very rare. And most teachers seemed to be just processing me, and I was just supposed to follow the rules, do what they said. And that led to my ability to get a good grade and then get out of that class and go on. And there were just so many classes, you know, all the way through college where I didn't really learn anything other than following rules and regurgitating exactly what I was told to regurgitate.
Right.
And similar process, you know, when I became a teacher and I, you know, have worked the gamut from kindergarten through college, every level there's just that expectation from administrators. You just do what you're told. Do what we're telling you to do. Follow the line and teach to the textbook, you know, teach to the tests. Mm-hmm. And students are just not learning. And so I was just struggling because I care so much about learning and my own learning and trying to be the teacher, really, I never had. And just all of the pushback from the administrators and even a lot of students, especially in college, that didn't really want to learn. They just wanted to be processed and have fun. School wasn't important to them at all. They just wanted to, you know, get an easy A, pass their classes, and get out of there as quickly as possible. So I kind of, these books in many ways started, you know, 20, 30 years ago, but really been working on the last 10 years. And it just, I was seeing that the educational system in America was getting to a point of no return where learning is being squeezed out of the process. And so I just had to say something about that.
One of the phrases that you use, teaching to the test, that's one that I heard a lot when I was a high school teacher. And what I learned from that was, it's nice if you have things to bring to them. You know, I was a band director and a chorus director and a theater teacher. And that was nice if you had things that you could bring to the party. But as long as they did well on their standardized test, we could keep getting our funding, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
This is the, and you talk about how this developed in America. I really kind of look back to the days of Henry Ford when he figured out that if you put everything on an assembly line, we can make cars a lot faster and therefore theoretically cheaper. This kind of thinking in the early 20th century kind of got fused into measurement of students, especially as students stayed in school longer and longer, which happened kind of during the Depression. All of a sudden, we didn't need all those teenage boys out there competing for jobs, so let's make it easier for them to stay in school and stay out of the job market.
Right, because there weren't enough jobs. And,
right.
And you saw the expansion, not only the expansion of just the youth population, but with the Great Depression, the contraction of the labor market, not enough jobs. And then you also had, you know, in America, and then slowly in other democratic, quote-unquote, democratic countries in Europe and then other places, you know, you had a lot of excluded populations, non-whites, minorities. And, you know, in the early 20th century, they were being allowed into schools for the first time. So the 20th century was a century of the opening up of the educational system. So there were tons of new students, which required a lot more schools, and then reformers also wanted to kind of create more levels of schools and different kinds of institutions. And so you had the junior high school invented, the high school, the junior college. You had trade schools. So you had all these new institutions, and there was this general requirement by the 30s and 40s that everyone needed to go through high school and graduate with a high school degree, and that became the primary credential to get a decent job. But, you know, 50 years later, that wasn't enough, and there was another economic crisis in the 70s. Again, a glut of educated, high school educated, you know, workers out there, not enough jobs. And so slowly you had a ratcheting up, and now you needed a two-year degree, or now you need a four-year degree, or now you need a graduate degree. And so there's been this proliferation of credentialing of students, and it seems like every kind of niche out there in the labor market requires its own special degree. Right. And that was partly engineered by professors in the university systems and partly engineered by the labor market itself and employers. And so people go to school now to, you know, get a badge that says they're employable. And if you don't have that badge, largely you're not even considered for a position.
So the myth in the old days before the 20th century was that universities taught you how to think, and therefore things only started to get messed up when you got into the 20th century. But as you point out in your books, that's not really accurate.
So the idea about how schools used to focus on skills and critical thinking, that schools have never focused on skills, that schooling in every culture, including the United States, for most of human history, it's been more like going to church, where you just have to act the right way and say the right things and, you know, follow the right rituals. And as long as you do that for a set number of years, and then, you know, your symbolic, you know, graduation ceremony, your first communion and, you know, other things, bar mitzvahs, you know, right, that different cultures have, that's what schooling was. You know, you at a certain point, you did your final examination, which really wasn't an examination. It was more like a public reckoning where the public recognized you, hey, you just finished your school, and now you have the badge. Often it came with a special kind of dress or a piece of paper or, you know, something that set you apart from other people. Mm-hmm. And even medical schools. You know, medical schools really didn't become professionalized until the 30s and 40s. That, mm-hmm. you know, up until then, even the early part of the 20th century, it was the wild, wild west out there. And you had a lot of doctors that had no idea what they were doing. They didn't understand disease or the human body at all. There was very little accreditation. And that was one of the big reasons why that we had a push towards a system of credentials based on skills. So really it was the early 20th century that educational reformers said, hey, we need to kind of transform schooling from a symbolic process into a process that really does teach real learning and real skills. And that's been uneven over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st century. It's I think, a worthwhile process. I think it's important. I think people recognize now more than ever that we need skilled and knowledgeable people for, you know, to keep a democracy healthy, for the labor market, to keep a labor market growing and companies profitable. But there's so many, you know, levels of schooling, middle school, high school, so many degree programs out there in college where students are not being taught real-life skills, useful knowledge, and they're just being sorted and processed and stamped and given a piece of paper and passed on to the next level without, you know, any benefit to themselves. And so that's part of what I'm trying to point out here is that, you know, I think it's a good thing to teach students real knowledge, real skills, you know, focus on real learning. Schools have never really done that, and they started to do that in the 20th century. And this idea of trying to measure, you know, what's going on in schools and how well are they doing what they're supposed to be doing, I support that wholeheartedly. However, we've been doing it all wrong, and we're not actually capturing learning. So we're not actually getting to the purported purpose of what schools are supposed to be doing.
For example, you talk about the SATs that have been around a long time, longer than I thought, mm-hmm. and about IQ scores and how they're basically used to measure how well you'll do on other standardized tests.
highly correlated to parental income and you know, where you happen to live. You
right.
know, they don't perfectly capture what's in a student's brain.
And grades are subjective. Even if you give standardized tests, there are levels of subjectivity, which is one reason that standardized tests have been controversial for some time. You know, how do we make them unbiased, for example? How do we take away the benefit of growing up in a middle class? But one of the things that you point out in the books is that if you have parents that read and they read to you and they encourage reading, this is basically the single most significant thing that a student can do to do well in standardized tests and to do well in all of their education. If you're a good reader, you'll do well pretty much across the board. And if you're not, you're in big trouble from the very earliest grades on up.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the pieces. And of course, in what you read, you know, having the proper cultural vocabulary.
Right.
And so a long-standing problem with SAT tests is that they use language and vocabulary that not all, you know, kids are accustomed to growing up. The different kids, especially, you know, immigrants speaking different languages, hearing different languages and words and vocabulary at home, you know, their language is not on the test. So they're at a disadvantage there.
Right.
That they don't necessarily know all the words. But there are many other things. So along with, you know, parents that read to their kids tend to be, you know, middle class or higher. And that means that they have enough money to provide, you know, extracurricular activities. There's enough food on the table. The child is getting enough rest. They're going to the doctor regularly, you know, to have their physical exams. You know, all these basic things that, you know, test scores are influenced by whether or not that child got enough sleep the night before, you
Absolutely.
Know, and whether or not they had a decent breakfast. They're also influenced by the social environment. You know, is the home a peaceful, calm, nurturing environment? Are they getting along with their friends at school? You know, having a upset relationships, that could be the determining factors of a low test grade. It has nothing to do with the student's academic ability necessarily. You know,
right.
other things can impact it. So designing the right tools to capture learning is very difficult. You know, there are many things that are inside of a student that we're trying to measure, but there are also many things outside of a student that also play a role. And we can't design the perfect test to capture all of that. And if we do try to capture all of that, it's going to take a really expensive, you know, group of researchers with a lot of different instruments to try to capture all of that data, which a lot of, you know, social scientists are doing.
Right.
And published wonderful studies that have really given us insights into what makes students learn and how do we actually measure that and how do we track that over time to see if it sticks and develops, you know. So it's a worthwhile goal, but it needs to be done under the right circumstances, and more importantly, for the right purposes, for educational purposes. But most of our tests are not done for educational purposes. They're not designed for learning. They're designed for political purposes. They're designed to sort and rank students because school is a competition, and there can only be so many winners, and there has to be a lot of losers. And then only the winners go on to, you know, acclaim and, you know, the best schools, best high schools and best colleges. So we're using our tests for political purposes. It doesn't help students learn. If we want educational tests, educational assessments that get at student learning, we need teachers to be designing them or at least giving a lot of feedback to how they're designed. And then teachers need a lot of input because, as you said, you're a band director, right?
Right.
It's important for you to assess musical ability.
Right.
So number one, when we take all these standardized tests right now, what kind of tests are we not doing? Music tests.
Right.
What kind of programs are being cut because there's not enough time or not enough money? Music programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, music is important.
Yeah.
And I think that all kids should have musical education, probably up through high school, but, you know, maybe just middle school. But there needs to be music programs, certainly for a substantial amount of schooling. But they're being cut.
Right.
Because in our current environment, music is deemed, you know, an extra. You
right.
know, and it's not essential.
Right.
But it should be essential. And it should have its own set of metrics. And those metrics should be designed by musicians who understand how music works. And,
yes.
and singing is not the same as playing a piano or playing a trumpet.
Right.
So you need different measurements for different instruments, right?
Right.
There's some commonality in terms of reading sheet music, for example, but there's also some major differences for different kinds of instruments. So there needs to be different kinds of tests and assessments for the different kinds of musical abilities.
Yeah, right? with all the emphasis
and that's
on...
essentially across the curriculum. Yeah. That's what we're talking about, right?
Right, with all the emphasis on STEM classes, anything that's outside that, including things that are important, like the arts, but also
right.
like physical fitness. I mean, they don't have PE
right.
classes much anymore because they got to take another science class or another math class. And not that those
right.
things aren't important, but if we're trying to produce balanced human beings, we can't just squeeze them through a tube and say, okay, this should make them a good technician or something.
Exactly. And you mentioned STEM classes. You know, one of the ironies of our STEM-focused, you know, curriculum, especially through high school, is it's not teaching critical thinking.
Right.
That it's being churned into kind of, you read a textbook, you follow the formulas, you follow the rules, you know, your teacher says, do this, do these steps, and then you get your grade. It's just a procedural, you know, formulaic type of activity. That's not what science is. You know, science, there's a lot of procedures and formulas, there's a lot of math, you know, but at the same time, there's a lot of judgment, and there's a lot of gray areas. And there's a lot of interpreting numbers to try to figure out what is significant or not, finding the signal from the noise. But most science classes in America are not teaching judgment and critical thinking.
Right.
And so students are getting a kind of a hollowed out version of STEM and math that doesn't necessarily help them do well in higher education and on the labor market.
We're talking to J.M. Beach, the author of Can We Measure What Matters Most? And The Myths of Measurement and Meritocracy. Both are from Roman and Littlefield. Available in paperback as a set or individually, although I've got to say, having had the opportunity to read them both, there really is a flow between one to the other, and it's really significant. This way you're not reading a gigantic book, if you just get two smaller books. And you talk about so much in here about student surveys, which are really used a lot more significantly than they need to be about deciding whether or not college teachers, professors, instructors keep getting hired, but it's an easier way to do than to have, say, supervisors who go in and see one of their instructors, one of their lecturers or professors teaching a class, not just once, but a lot of times, because most times administrators are teaching classes also, because that's cheaper than hiring strictly an administrator who doesn't do any teaching and so forth. So they use student surveys, which are not exactly a perfectly accurate example. If you tick off a student, they give you a nasty mark, then you're in trouble. So what happens? You try your very best not to make any of your students unhappy. And what's the easiest way to make them happy? Don't expect a lot from them. Give them easy grades. And what's accomplished by that?
Right, nothing. I mean, and it turns, you know, education really into another service industry. And students are just expecting a fun time. They want entertainment
yep.
rather than actual learning, you know. And so, in order for the college professors, and again, most, as I emphasize in the book, most college professors these days are short-term adjuncts. They do not have more than a one-year contract. In many cases, it's
right.
just a semester contract. So
right.
they have a job for 3 or 4 months, and then there's no guarantee of a job after that. And so their employment status primarily rests on whether or not they please their students and get high marks on these student evaluation surveys. Nothing else really matters in terms of employability. And so they just want to make sure that their students are happy. Not
mm-hmm.
that the students have learned, but the students are happy and that the students like them.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what the student evaluation surveys measure. And there's a plethora of social scientific data out there. That these surveys are nothing more than likability surveys. You know, do the students like me? Are they having a good time? You know, are they pleased by the class? They don't really reflect learning, which is a shame because that supposedly is what higher education is all about.
You mentioned before about it would be wonderful if teachers had more input into tests, especially standardized tests particularly. They have a certain amount of flexibility in the tests that they give in their own classroom. But as far as standardized tests, you have to do what they give you, and the parameters are really tough. My wife had a retinal tear, and she was overseeing a class, taking a standardized test, and she said, "I've got to go. Something terrible is going wrong with my eye." And the other person administrating the test with her said, "If you leave now, you could have your certificate pulled. I'll turn you in."
Oh, wow.
And she thought, what is the matter with this system? So what do we do with administrators? I mean, do they become like the managers in a factory? Because that's sort of the way they're looking at things now. What do we do with administrators? There are very, very many of them, and they need work too. But how do we make them do the things that they can do best and let the teachers do the things that need to be done?
Right. Well, one of the main points that I point out in the Can We Measure book at the end is that, first of all, we need to acknowledge that many administrators simply don't know what they're doing. And this goes across the board. When you look at the management literature on businesses, nonprofit organizations, you look at leadership, what do managers do? How much do managers control? You know, it's very little. And there is this kind of inflated aura around CEOs and seeing them as corporate saviors that kind of determine the fate of an organization. And we worship our business leaders as these magical people. And that trickles down to all other organizations, including schools, superintendents, administrators, principals. You know, these are magic people that somehow have control, and they either make a good school or they break a bad school, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's all false. Yeah, most CEOs have no idea what they're doing and what the organization is actually doing. And they don't control really much of anything. That it's largely a symbolic function. And the same thing goes with educational administrators, that they're just pushing a lot of papers, enforcing a lot of rules. It's more a legal and political job than it is an educational job. Now, that needs to be done. You know, that's part of the culture that we live in. We have bureaucracy, and we have politics, and we have rules and regulations. Now, that's another discussion, whether we should have more or less of that, and that would determine, you know, the size of the administrative staffs of businesses and schools. However, with that being said, bracket it off, a school should be in the business of teaching students how to learn and focused on learning skills and knowledge. And so whatever else administrators might be doing, we need people who know about teaching and learning in charge of teaching and learning. And the people that should be evaluating teaching and learning should be people that know about teaching and learning, not paper pushers. And so in our schools today, paper pushers who know nothing about teaching and learning, who have never been teachers, who have no understanding of what learning actually is or what it looks like or how it's accomplished, they're evaluating learners and teachers. And that is just insane. You know, it's the equivalent of having a priest go into a, you know, factory and start evaluating, you know, whether or not they're producing enough canned peas or Tesla cars. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. That's the wrong person for the job. So we need to kind of rethink, what is the job we're trying to accomplish? How do we actually accomplish that job? And so if we want learning and if we want quality teaching, we need people who know about learning and quality teaching who are in charge of those activities, right? And so in terms of evaluating, again, I'm for accountability measures. I'm for measuring student learning. I'm for measuring teaching. But it needs to be done the right way, and it needs to be valid, which is a very important concept in the sciences, the right tools for the right job. And so we need educators and educational researchers who are in charge of evaluating teaching and learning, not administrators who don't know about those subjects. You know, personally, I think administrators should be paid the same amount as janitors. I think they serve the same basic function. You know, janitors clean up the mess around the school and make sure the school facility is in place. And administrators kind of, you know, control the political and paperwork aspects, making sure that the school is in place and the way it needs to be. Neither one, janitors nor administrators, know anything about teaching and learning. They shouldn't be interfering with those activities.
You know, if universities were designed by professors, then the best teachers would make the biggest salary on campus, and the people who do things like coach football would make a fair salary, but not an insanely high salary, as we tend to do in college football. And you talk about when football teams and cheerleaders and marching bands and all those other kind of things became, and fraternities and all became part of the college experience, showed that universities and colleges needed to figure out some way to attract students, and having fun stuff for them to be involved in was a way of doing that. And I cannot tell you how many people that I have heard say, oh, I went to this school or that school because their football team is a great football team.
Right, exactly.
And I thought, well, you know, if you're learning how to be a coach, then that would be a brilliant decision. But if you're going to be an engineer, I don't really see any correlation whatsoever.
and what's insane is just the, you know, when you follow the money, how much are those football coaches making? You know, how much do college presidents make? You know, we're talking millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Now, on the other side, how much does your average adjunct professor make? The majority of professors in this country, they're lucky if they can pull in $25,000 to $30,000 a year.
Oh, yeah.
That's just, I mean, there are so many adjunct professors who are impoverished, who are on welfare, because they simply cannot make enough money to pay all their bills. There are adjunct professors who live in tents because they cannot afford a proper place to live. There's been some stories about professors living in tents. I mean, it's just mind-boggling that we can pay, you know, college presidents and football coaches millions of dollars, but yet the majority of the professors, they can't even pull in, you know, more than 30 grand.
Yeah.
It's just, where are our priorities? And then you can think about the same thing in public schools, you know, K through 12. You know, principals and assistant principals and superintendents make very large, nice salaries with full benefits. That's a fraction of what the teachers actually get.
Yep.
So it seems a bit off, you know, if the organization is focused on a job to produce a certain kind of, you know, service or product, it seems like the people who make the service or deliver make the product or deliver the service, they should be getting their fair share of the profits or the money that's coming in. But so often that's not how it is, you know, including in for-profit businesses, that you have CEOs taking the lion's share of the income,
yep,
and frontline workers are not paid their fair share.
Yep.
You know, it's the frontline workers who make the organization actually accomplish its goal. They should be paid a fair share, and, you know, if the organization does really well, they should be paid more, you know.
Yep.
And schools, you know, if schools are educating more of their students or, you know, doing that, there should be bonuses. But rarely are there bonuses tied to, you know, actual learning developments for students in schools.
Sad but true. I wish we had more time. I'd love to talk to you about community colleges. We'll just have to set up another time and talk again.
You bet.
We've been talking to Josh Beach, who is the author of Can We Measure What Matters Most? Why Educational Accountability Metrics Lower Student Learning and Demoralize Teacher, and The Myths of Measurement and Meritocracy, Why Accountability Metrics in Higher Education Are Unfair and Increase Inequality. Both of them are from Roman and Littlefield, available at bookstores and online. You can go to Roman, that's ROWMAN.com, for more about these books and others. And Josh, do you have websites that folks can go to?
Yeah, very easy, jmbeach.com, www.jmbeach.com.
We could discuss this for a lot longer. We'll need to do it again.
This has
been really good. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Doc.
Absolutely. And our thanks again to Josh Beach with his two new books from Roman and Littlefield, Can We Measure What Matters Most? And The Myths of Measurement and Meritocracy. Some challenges and some great ideas as we go into a new year. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite podcast and on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.